Your ideas, what you consume, influences who you become. On the Mind and Matter podcast, we learn together from the best scientists and thinkers alive today about how your mind-body reacts to what you feed it. Before starting Mind and Matter, I spent 10 years in academia doing scientific research. I got a PhD in neuroscience, where I focused on neuroendocrinology and the neurobiology of behavior. And before that, I specialized in molecular, developmental, and evolutionary genetics. I use my scientific background to help parse and translate the information that guests share on the podcast. In addition to the podcast, I write long-form written content inspired by the show, where I integrate what I've learned across episodes. I also have a free weekly newsletter where I provide you with upcoming guests, share links, and provide commentary on scientific studies and research that I'm reading, and more. Visit mindandmatter.substack.com to find all of my content. This episode is ad-free, and I rely on my audience to support my efforts. If you're getting value from this content, please consider becoming a paid subscriber to the Mind and Matter Substack. For just $5 a month, you'll get early access to episodes and other content, full episode transcripts, and I'll prioritize answering your questions in emails and the comments sections. You can also support me by checking out the links in the episode description to my affiliate partners, who make various health and wellness products that I use and enjoy myself. You'll receive a discount and help support the podcast that way. And if you want the benefits of a paid subscription, but it's not in your budget, simply sign up for my free weekly newsletter, send me an email, and I'll give you a complimentary paid subscription. Word of mouth is the best way to help the podcast grow, so if you like what I'm doing, please share your favorite episodes with family and friends. The purpose of the podcast is to provide you with information obtained largely from primary sources, the people doing the research and producing new knowledge. This content is never meant to serve as medical advice. And with that, enjoy the episode.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start off by just telling everyone a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a professor at the Johns Hopkins Behavioral Pharmacology Research Unit and work with some colleagues here doing cannabis science. So we try to systematically do research that helps inform policy, regulation, decision-making, clinical decision-making, and things like that. Really just trying to put empirical data behind some of the claims around cannabis, whether it's good, whether it's bad, or somewhere in between. And we try to be agnostic to all of that and let our data do the speaking for us.
And do you guys work with humans, animal models? What's your modality?
Yeah, so in the lab here, there's a translational approach here. So there are some scientists part of the cannabis science lab that do preclinical work. And I personally do work with humans almost exclusively.
And so a lot of your work informs policy. How, you know, before we get into the science of it, how direct is that connection? Do you work directly with policymakers, or do you just sort of work in an area that's of interest to policymakers who you hope then read it?
It's a little of both. And, you know, when I started out doing research with cannabis, it was only us doing things that we thought would be helpful. But, you know, that's 20 years ago, before widespread legalization and decriminalization and changes in a retail marketplace really coming about. So it was pretty tangential. But now, you know, we are very intentional in monitoring and seeing what's happening and seeing what kinds of changes in the laws are being put forth and seeing changes in product types. And then we basically use that as a foundation for determining what kinds of research projects we think are the most important and what we go after. So I guess to go back to your original question, you know, we do research that we believe is very helpful to policy and decision-making and things like that. But we also have worked directly with legislators on language and draft bills and legislation. I was part of a task force work group that helped design the medical cannabis law in the state of Maryland. And we've been called on by the FDA and other regulatory agencies to kind of come in and speak to what we've seen in the laboratory and how that might help them inform their policies and regulations at the state and federal level.
So you study cannabis, also known as marijuana, and it goes by many names. Obviously, you know, it's a plant. People use it for recreational and medicinal purposes. As a scientist, as a biology guy, how do you what is cannabis to you? A lot of people think of it as being synonymous with THC, but from a chemical or pharmacological perspective, what is it?
Yeah, so I try to not even use the term cannabis anymore because it's an umbrella term that 20 years ago was meaningful in that if you said cannabis, 97% of the time we were talking about dried flowers of a plant that were rolled up and smoked or stuffed into a pipe or a bong and smoked. And that was it. And it was always THC dominant in terms of chemical composition. But the reality is once we opened up a retail marketplace, there are hundreds of different kinds of cannabis-based products that exist now. And so I try as much as I can to talk about cannabis as generality, but when we talk about specific things and whether it's good, whether it's bad, how do you use it, what's the decision-making, I try to be much more precise because when we talk about those kinds of things, health impacts, we need to know what the primary chemical constituent is, what the intended route of administration is, and there's further nuance beyond that. But those are the two key things where I try as hard as I can to say THC-dominant cannabis, CBD-dominant cannabis, CBG-dominant cannabis, and then talk about whether it's intended to be inhaled, orally ingested, topically applied, or some other manner of consumption.
And, you know, one of the things that's always been interesting, but also tricky from a research perspective about cannabis of any kind is, is that it's not one thing. People consume different types and we have to be specific about what exactly the differences are. They consume it in different ways. The research historically has not always, but often been, we often see researchers using preparations where subjects are consuming something like pure THC or something that is different from what people are using out in naturalistic settings, out in the real world when they go buy cannabis legally or illegally and then consume it. Can you talk a little bit about the pros and cons of doing that, of studying sort of the isolated molecules versus the actual products that are out there in the real world?
Yeah. So, and this will be a recurring theme through our conversation, is there's a lot of nuance to cannabis science and to retail cannabis goods that have to be factored in and are important in how you talk about it, how you think through these things. So we have studied both whole plant products as well as isolated individual chemical constituents. I think it's very important to do both because we want to have science that is reflective of whole plant botanical products. And there's a whole theory behind, you know, is the whole greater than the sum of its parts kind of thing. You know, there's an entourage theory about how, you know, the natural plant product is somehow superior to the individual chemical constituents. But you need the science to back that up. But at the same time, if all of the science is done with this whole plant botanical product, which is made up of hundreds of individual chemical entities that vary from one plant to the next, to the next, to the next, can we say anything very confidently about what the individual constituents do without studying them? And so part of what we are doing here is to understand the effects of individual chemical entities and how they interact with each other. And you can kind of take some of that data to then go back to whole plant modalities and say, okay, well, in this scenario, according to entourage hypotheses, these two things balance each other out, whereas this one exacerbates something else. Can we take those specific hypotheses and pull them into the lab and say, is this true or is it not? And I think that that's important and becoming more important because what we're seeing is our cannabis industry claims about these things in the absence of empirical data.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, you know, one of the remarkable things about cannabis is the variety, or at least the apparent variety that's out there. If you go into a retail store, so I live in Washington, there's cannabis shops all over the place. You go in, you've got hundreds of different products, many different product types. For now, let's just focus on the most common type, which is flower, THC dominant flower, and the most common method of consumption, which is inhalation, either by smoking or vaporization. So, but even within that, there's a lot of variety. There's a lot of different strains or cultivars or chemovars, depending on the nomenclature you want to use, that are out there, or at least marketed as such. Yeah. And, you know, there's purportedly hundreds of different varieties of THC dominant cannabis flower. And there are phenotypic, like morphological differences. Some of them, they vary by color, they vary by, you know, the shape and the density of the buds and so forth. They vary by aroma. You can smell differences. Oftentimes this is best done side by side. You can smell one, smell the other, and they often have a common core to them, that marijuana smell, but there's a lot of variety there in the aroma. And people say that there are a lot of different effects, that different cultivars will be better or worse for giving you a certain type of psychoactive effect, or might work for one medical application where another strain doesn't work at all. Some might have side effects that others don't, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all of this apparent or purported variety out there. And a key question is how much of that is real and how much of that is marketing. To sort of get into this question, if we're thinking about THC dominant flower, the most common type of cannabis product consumed, what is it chemically? So it's obviously got THC in it, but what else is in there that accounts for some of that variation in aroma and potentially some of those differences in effects that people claim?
Yeah. So when you think of the cannabis plant, and again, I am not a botanist, but on the macro level, right? So there are three kind of common core types of chemical entities in the cannabis plant. There are phytocannabinoids, and these are the things that are unique to the cannabis plant. Many of them, but not all of them, directly engage with the body's endocannabinoid system, albeit in different ways. Then you have terpenes or terpenoids, and these are kind of the flavor, the aroma, the scent type chemicals. And again, some are unique to cannabis and some are not. You know, a lot of them are common to other types of plants, citrus plants and things like that. And then you have, so you got your cannabinoids, your terpenes, and then your flavonoids, right? And so a lot of it is the structure and integrity of the plant itself and waxes and things like that. So really, there's no reason to believe that they're pharmacologically active, but they're important parts of the skeleton of the plant, so to speak, right? And so when a behavioral pharmacologist like myself comes in, you know, I'm drilled in and focused on the phytocannabinoids and the terpenes. And, you know, the terpenes are, there are certain ones that, again, in the cannabis industry, you will see these claims about this variety is better for anxiety and this variety is better for insomnia because of these terpenes, right? And there's a basis for that, largely preclinical work, but a little bit in a growing literature of clinical work that kind of backs some of that up. But most of that science is research on those particular entities in isolation. And very little research has gone the way of, if you go into the dispensary and you say, okay, I'm going to get OG Kush for whatever health condition, and that's going to be better than Purple Haze or Blue Dream or any of the other strains of cannabis available at the time. And going back to your point, yes, these different strains can look different, they can smell different, but by and large, there's an abundance of chemical overlap in the presence of certain chemical entities and the ratio and actual concentration of these things. So when you go into a dispensary, I estimate probably about 85% of those things, the dominant phytocannabinoid is going to be delta 9 THC. The next one is going to be CBD or CBN or CBG. But those are going to be in much, much, much smaller concentrations compared to delta 9 THC. We're talking 18 to 24% versus 1, maybe 2%, most likely less than 1% on all of this other stuff, right? Terpenes, half, 1, maybe 2%. So we're talking incredible amounts of overlap in the chemical composition of all of these different THC dominant flowers. And the other thing that many people don't recognize is that even if you were to take one particular strain, right? Let's call it Blue Dream. Blue Dream purchased from a dispensary in Washington versus Blue Dream purchased from a dispensary in Maryland, where I live, might be very chemically different. And it could be because, again, the growing conditions, how they were handled, these things from the generational growing and cultivating of these things, these plants change over time. And the chemical expression of the plants based on their genetics can change based on the environment in which they're grown, when they're harvested, and all of that stuff. And then individual buds vary chemically from even the same plant. Mm-hmm. The THC concentration in a bud at the top of the plant, closest to the lights or the sun or wherever it's grown, is going to be different from the buds at the bottom of the plant, the left side, the right side. So even if we were to say, okay, Blue Dream is X percent THC, X percent CBD, X percent pinene, limonene, linalool, whatever, that happens to be the chemical signature of the one bud that was tested from that crop and is not necessarily exactly the same for all of the other buds from that crop, much less the next crop, much less the crop grown across the country 18 generations later. So the naming convention for strains is interesting from a marketing perspective. I think that there's likely some consistency, but it's not precise. And I think there's more overlap than difference, and there's inadequate research to show how much of that is true chemical composition driving pharmacology versus I'm buying it for a reason. I intend to have some certain effect. The guy that sold it to me said, it's great for this. So I have this whole bias going into it of this is going to do this for me. This other guy said, yeah, it's definitely going to do that.
Yep.
And it's more likely to do that than do something completely different.
Right. So there's this expectation effect. This bias can come in based on what you're expecting the product to do. It's reinforced by what people tell you to do, often people with an interest in selling you that effect. Before we get into entourage effects and things like that, you know, another key variable here is dose dependent effects. So I want to talk about that a little bit, and let's just focus on just THC to start with. So, sure. You know, there's a common belief out there that some strains will reliably make you sleepy and some strains will reliably make you energized, sort of, you know, the upper and the downer version of cannabis strains. How much of that in principle can be explained by just, you know, people self-titrating the dose that they're consuming? So, you know, for example, I could take the exact same strain, the exact same THC concentration, the exact same everything. I could smoke or inhale or take in some other ways a little bit of that. I could also take a larger dose of the exact same product with the exact same chemical composition. Could you drive both types of effects using the same thing just at two different doses?
Absolutely. THC's effects are very dose dependent. You know, your example in terms of arousal is one key thing. Another one is anxiety, right? Low doses of THC can be anxiolytic. High doses can be anxiogenic, right? And so where you are on the dose response curve is going to drive a very different user experience. The other thing is where you are on the dose curve in terms of the drug composition. So similar to alcohol, you can have a different experience on the ascending limb. So as the drug is increasing in concentration in your body versus when it's decreasing. Alcohol is a stimulant as you're increasing blood alcohol, and then it's a massive sedative on the descending limb. And so you can get different effects at different depending on how long it's been since you took your dose, in addition to how big a dose you took.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as someone who worked in the cannabis industry for a number of years and studied the chemistry and the responses people have to this stuff, I would say that a fair and conservative statement is, if you know, and we're talking about THC dominant cannabis here, a significant, I'm not going to say all, but a significant proportion of the variation in the effects people report from THC dominant cannabis can be explained by the amount of cannabis you consume on any given occasion. And that's going to be a function of the dose, how much you take, and your history of taking it. In other words, your sensitivity to the THC. But, you know, a lot of the effects out there that people map onto different products that are supposedly the sleepy product versus the energizing product, a lot of that, not necessarily all of it, but a lot of it can be explained simply by how much THC they've consumed and how sensitive they happen to be to it at the time they take it.
Other thing that's often overlooked is the environment that you're in and the intention of the use experience, right? And so if you take a small dose and then go outside on a bright sunny day, you might feel more invigorated and more energized. And hey, let's go for a run. Let's be active. But you know, if you take your dose and you're curled up in a dark basement on a couch, are you going to want to go for a run? No, you're going to sit down and play Xbox or watch a movie or just be lazy, right? And so a lot of it can be dependent on that. You know, the psychedelic world is notorious for talking about the importance of set and setting in a drug experience. Mm-hmm. But I think the same can be applied to cannabis as well. I think it very much is important. And we see this across drug classes, not just cannabis and psychedelics, but you know, the environment, the intent, whether you're in a social situation versus using on your own, all of those things can impact the overall user experience. You know, are you at a party or are you hanging out with your grandparents, right? You know, your response and how you behaviorally function and feel is going to be impacted by all of those things.
Mm-hmm. So even though we can explain a lot of the variance in effects to THC-dominant cannabis products with the dose of the THC, the sensitivity and the use history of that person with THC, and the set and setting, the contextual factors in which people consume it, there are still a lot of very interesting molecules in these products. Many of them have pharmacological properties that would suggest the possibility that they're contributing to the psychoactive and or medicinal effects. And many people certainly make those claims. So many anecdotes out there about this that you can't really ignore them. The idea here is often referred to as the entourage effect. It's the idea that all of or many of the cannabinoids, terpenes, and or other things in the plant interact with each other. Many of them are pharmacologically active at different sites, different receptors, things like this. And it's really the constellation of these things that you consume together with the other factors like dose and context that are going to dictate what the experience is like or what the medical effects might be. Can you summarize what the entourage effect is conceptually in your own words and sort of just start to give us a perspective on how much evidence has existed for this historically before we go into some of your more recent work?
Yeah. So you know, the entourage effect has been around for a long time. And this goes back to research done in the 70s, I think, even and maybe even before, late 60s, 70s, definitely by the early 80s, where you know, people would do research studies with a pure THC and then like a cannabis extract or a hashish or something like that. And they would see, you know, unexpected or uniquely different effects in one study versus another. And there have been some studies that have directly compared these things, but very, very few. And so again, the idea behind the entourage effect and the importance of it to the cannabis industry really emerged in the late 90s and early 2000s when people started talking about making the push for cannabis legalization for medicinal purposes at the state level. There had to be an argument that cannabis as a whole plant entity was uniquely different, was perhaps in some cases better and safer and more applicable for medicinal use or therapeutic benefit compared with just THC, which is FDA approved in the form of dronabinol, right? So there is a pharmaceutical formulation of THC that is approved by the FDA that's legal and can be prescribed. And so there was a big push to really emphasize that.
I see. So conceptually, there's not just sort of the scientific idea about the interaction of chemicals. There was also a specific policy motivation for something like this being true.
Yeah, very big policy motivation. And again, when you look at the science, there's evidence to support the entourage effect or certain hypotheses there, and there's also evidence to refute it. And as we talked about at the beginning, nuance becomes important, right? So a lot of the interactions and the differences between strains of cannabis or cannabis combinations or whole plant cannabis versus just THC by itself are going to be driven by, what relative concentrations are we talking about? What else is in the plant and how it's taken? So one really important a good example of this is CBD, right? And so right now, the common theory is that high CBD strains or high CBD containing plants or cannabis products are safer and less potent than high THC with very little or no CBD products. And a lot of that was driven by flower that came out where CBD was overexpressed, just over the last 10, 15 or so years, right? And while I think the data show that that's the case when it's inhaled, in most cases, not all cases, but where we have to kind of look at the nuance is, is CBD actually attenuating THC's effects in that situation? Or is, when you overexpress CBD in a plant, are you over or under expressing something else? Mm-hmm. The THC concentration in a 1-to-1 flower is much lower. It's usually around 8, 9, 10% of each.
Yeah. So there's like you're basically saying there's a confound. Yeah. If you've got higher CBD, you also have lower THC. So
have lower THC and you might have higher or lower other things that are very important pharmacologically that we just don't understand yet. Mm-hmm. The flip of that is that, before I go on the flip, the important thing there too is that there have been a number of studies that have specifically gone after that. Does CBD attenuate the effects of THC? And for every study that says yes, there's a study that says no, and there's probably two that say it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. So it's in between, right? So it's a very mixed bag. And why is there a mixed bag? Let's drill down on the research methods. So in many cases, the approach was to pre-dose individuals with oral CBD and then have them inhale THC.
Mm, and that's usually with a very high dose of CBD, right?
Different routes of administration here. The timing of the onset of the drugs is going to be different. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't fully represent how it's used in the real world, right?
Yep.
So there's methodological differences across these studies that likely explain why some of them say, yes, it attenuates. Some say it doesn't. And then you get some that say, not only does it not attenuate THC effects, some say it exacerbates it. Hmm. And that's where the route of administration comes in. So the flip of this is that when it's inhaled, we see more evidence of entourage type effects where CBD reduces, or you see less strong THC effects. But on the oral dose side, there's more research and a couple of studies from my lab in particular that have come out recently where we say simultaneous oral dosing of a high CBD product, if you match the THC dose, you get a high THC and a high CBD, THC dose is exactly the same, same route, same everything. We see an exacerbation of the THC effects. And it's through a metabolic interaction between CBD and THC.
I see. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. So like in principle, you know, In theory, I could explain this, you know, a couple of different ways. One, you know, if you think about concurrent administration through the inhaled route of THC and CBD, and we know pharmacologically, you know, THC is activating CB1 receptors. CBD is not doing that. It's probably actually interfering with the ability of something like THC to activate the CB1 receptor. Now you've got plausible biological means by which CBD could interfere with THC and potentially mitigate its side effects. On the other hand, I think there's something interesting metabolically going on with respect to how some of these molecules affect liver metabolism. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so CBD has been shown to be a pretty potent inhibitor of drug metabolism, specifically the two substrates that are used to metabolize THC. And so in one of our recent studies, again, identical doses of THC given the same ways to the same people, in the same study, just on two different occasions. When we had high doses of CBD given with a pretty high dose of THC, 20 milligrams of THC, when we looked at blood levels of THC in these individuals over across the course of the study, when the same dose of THC was given with a high dose of CBD, we saw double the THC blood levels and 10 times the 11-hydroxy metabolite THC blood level. So THC is metabolized two times. The first time the parent molecule is metabolized to another psychoactive substance, 11-hydroxy THC. And again, so that was increased tenfold at peak levels. And so we're talking about a substantially different drug effect based on just this metabolic interaction.
I see. So the idea there is if you take these things orally, CBD is affecting enzymes in the liver responsible for the metabolism of THC. And so you're actually getting higher blood levels of
THC concentrate. You're reducing your body's ability to eliminate THC. So therefore, your drug effects are stronger and longer lasting than if you take it without CBD. Now, again, coming back to one of our other things that we talked about earlier, this interaction is entirely dependent on dose and concentration in your brain and your blood and all of that stuff too, right? And so, you know, we saw this really strong interaction, but this was in a study with pretty high doses of both drugs. And we gave people some other drugs on top of all of that to probe which specific enzymes CBD was interrupting. But we've seen it in other studies as well, as have other scientists. So we know CBD inhibits THC metabolism through oral routes of administration. Now, some colleagues of ours at the University of Washington and Washington State have done kind of preclinical modeling of this interaction, and their science suggests that this is unique to oral dosing, and that you wouldn't see the same effects with inhalation. So again, we need to come back. We need more research to find out, okay, across different routes of administration, what's the level of pharmacological interaction and metabolic interaction between these drugs? And at what dose concentration does this happen? And at what ratio of CBD to THC? Does the ratio factor in? Do the total doses factor in? And if so, in what way? And once we do a few more studies like that, I think we can use statistics and modeling to really kind of fill in the blanks on exactly how this is going to happen to predict the outcome of a particular product being used by a particular individual.
So why exactly would we see such a different effect from oral versus inhaled routes of administration? Is it because when you consume these things orally, They go through the portal vein, and a higher proportion is metabolized by the liver before entering systemic circulation?
It has to do with the rate of absorption and the rate of elimination. So when you inhale a drug, you're getting your lungs are very efficient drug delivery mechanisms. You basically get almost all of the drug into your blood within minutes. You know, it gets absorbed very, very fast. And so you're getting this peak drug effects right away. Your peak concentrations happen almost immediately. And then your body works very quickly to eliminate. And so that's why with inhalation, the peak drug effects happen really fast. And then you get a pretty linear decline in drug effects. And it lasts, you know, an hour, 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. Mm-hmm. When you take THC orally, you don't feel anything for usually the first 30, 45 hour, right? And then the peak drug effects are sustained for a longer period of time, and there's a slower elimination. It's because there's a slower absorption of the drug by your gut into your blood. There's metabolism that happens in your gut, and as well as after it's absorbed. And so it's a very different level. Your body's continually absorbing the drug in different states of metabolism and breakdown, and for a longer period of time. And so when you have that inhibition happening on something that's happening slower, you can get these bigger, larger differences in terms of impact of liver enzyme functioning.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we start to think about these things in combination, you know, we've already seen from what you've told us, like it gets very complicated very quickly. The dose matters. Probably the relative ratio of compounds matters. The way you consume it matters. There's a whole other class of compounds that we're going to talk a little bit about that we haven't even started to talk about yet, and that's the terpenes. So can you say a little bit more about, you know, what are terpenes and what are some of the more prominent cannabis terpenes? And in the literature historically, you know, do any of them have pharmacological properties that would make us think or hypothesize that they could be contributing to the psychoactivity of cannabis?
Sure. And before I go there, just one more thing to add on that last piece is that the difference in the time course and the rate and the impact on the metabolic stuff, the other factor is that the viscosity of cannabinoids. Mm. They're lipophilic, and when you orally ingest it, it sticks to tissue, including your brain. Mm-hmm. So we find, interestingly enough, when you orally ingest cannabis, even at the peak level, highest drug effect, there are very low concentrations of the drug in your blood. And so it's not really circulating. It's a much slower elimination because of that. So these things get in and get into your brain and just stay there. They camp. And so it's a little bit different there as well.
Yeah. I mean, just one more thing before we move on, that might be worth adding there is, you know, I very often hear people say things like, well, I took 10 milligrams in the form of a cookie, and then I took 10 milligrams in the form of a gummy or a brownie, and it was a very different effect. And presumably that has to do with the fat composition of the substrate that these fat soluble molecules are in, which would affect the rate of absorption.
Yeah, for certain. And, you know, we've seen that, we've heard that. Now, to add another layer of complexity on top of that, you have the matrix the drug is in is going to drive how quickly it gets absorbed through the gut. How much is going to get absorbed versus gets metabolized right then and there. What the person ate and how long ago they ate it also impacts it considerably. So if you take a cannabinoid on an empty stomach, you're going to get far less drug. It's the opposite of alcohol and many other medications. You get far less drug absorption than if you take it with a meal, and in particular, a high fat meal. So high fat meals actually protect the drug and get it through your body faster than if you were to take it on an empty stomach or with a low fat meal. And then there's other impacts there too, where you know, there's nano emulsion technology to try to speed up and protect the drug. So there's a lot of innovation in the cannabis industry right now in this space. Again, without much published science. So my colleague Tori Spindle here at Hopkins just got a really nice grant from the National Institutes of Health to study this very thing. And so he's going to be doing a research study starting up this summer, where we're going to be giving people, you know, the same high THC distillate extract in a gummy, in a beverage, and in a brownie. Mm. And we're going to be able to look at fat content or macronutrient content, as well as the use of nanoemulsion technology versus not. So it'll be a nanoemulsed beverage versus just a straight distillate in a gummy and the distillate in a high fat brownie formulation. So it'll be fascinating.
Yeah, that sounds, yeah. No one that I'm aware of has done that type of study in a nice head-to-head way so far. It's pretty clear there's going to be differences, but what those differences are and knowing that with precision, I don't think we have that information yet.
Yeah. So again, important, because when you go back and you talk about regulatory decision-making, if a state decides their unit dose or max unit dose is 10 milligrams or 5 milligrams, is it appropriate to have that be the same across formulations or edible subtypes? Or does there need to be some kind of labeling difference, you know, fast acting, will hit you harder than this other thing, right? So, you know, we need the, and whether or not it impacts regulation at all, it's important from a public education perspective so that the user knows going into this. And there are folks that are savvy to this already. They've experienced it. They know it, and they adjust their doses and what they buy based on that. But as legalization, especially for non-medical purposes, is rolling out widely, many people don't. And so that's the kind of thing that we need to worry about. We need to get the message out there. We need good data behind it. And then we need some kind of, you know, packaging, labeling, warnings, so to speak, or at least something that conveys that kind of nuance to the user, so you don't end up with the people going in and saying, well, 5 milligrams was fine in this, I should be fine with 5 at that. And then you go past the point of comfort, and instead of a happy, relaxed time, you're curled up in a ball on a couch, scared and paranoid and wondering, what did I do? The sky's falling, right? So, and THC can go very quickly from one of those to the other. We're trying to minimize that.
Switching gears to terpenes. So again, remind people what these things are. Give us maybe 2 or 3 or 4 examples of the more prominent ones that typically are found in cannabis. And historically, you know, are any of these things known to affect brain receptors and other aspects of physiology that would make us think that they could be relevant to the psychoactivity?
Yeah. So, you know, there, again, there's probably more than 100 different terpenes in the cannabis plant, and they're going to be at different levels depending on the genetics of the plant, how it was grown and when it was harvested and all of that stuff. But, you know, when you look at the science behind these particular terpenes, you look at the relative concentrations that they exist naturally in the plants, or at least exist in current retail flower products. The heavy hitters are limonene, pinene, linalool, beta-caryophyllene, those kinds of things. There's probably a list of about 20 or so that people think are important in some way, shape, or form. The ones that we've been interested in and studying in the lab here are limonene, pinene, and myrcene. And we got interested in that based on published papers by Ethan Russo and a couple other people that kind of pulled together and triangulated preclinical data and some clinical data of these things in other formats, not necessarily in cannabis, and some cannabis industry stuff and anecdote. You know, these are among the more abundant terpenes that are found in cannabis plants. And they're the ones where we see when we look at, you know, a cannabis dispensary profile or a marketing page or whatever, these are the ones that people are calling out saying, this one or this particular strain has high amounts of this, therefore it does that. This particular terpene is associated with this kind of effect. And so for limonene, a lot of that is it helps with anxiety, it helps increase arousal, it does this. And I will say this, I've seen probably 10 different claims about what limonene does in different areas and different media here. So it's still one of those cases, and this is, I think, the case across the board with cannabis broadly. There are lots of claims, but there's not a lot of data. It's hard to refute claims in the absence of data. So, you know, limonene, the big thing is anxiety, it's arousal. So it's a citrus terpene found in, you know, lemons, limes, oranges, grapefruits, all of that kind of stuff. It's, if you walk down the cleaning aisle at your grocery store, Lemon Pledge, that's limonene, you know? So it's there, it's abundant. It's in other food products. It's in other household products. So it's everywhere, it's lemon scent, right? And it's in essential oils that people already are using homeopathically in their homes. You know, you get a diffuser, you put the essential oil in there. A lot of them have limonene, have pinene, have linalool, lavender scent, right? So these things are, there's a whole history of human use of these substances in various forms for health and wellness promotion. They also happen to be in the cannabis plant. So there's a fusion of these claims and feelings and beliefs around them. What we don't know is, okay, say one cannabis plant has 0.7% limonene in it, another has barely detectable levels, and one has 2% limonene in there. Is there a functional difference between those three plant cultivars simply based on the concentration of limonene? Who knows, right? And even if limonene at those varying concentrations, if the dose that you take is the same, what about the variation in all of the other chemicals? Can those trump the impact of limonene? We have no idea, right? And so part of the research we do here is to try to understand that. How important are these individual chemical entities? Are they strong enough to actually impact the effects of THC? And we're doing that because THC is largely the by far dominant chemical entity in cannabis products, and it is the chemical entity that is driving most of the effects that people associate and seek when they use cannabis products, whether for medicinal or non-medicinal purposes, right? And so, you know, our research is really saying, okay, are these interactions meaningful? If so, at what doses and what relative concentrations, and what is actually going to happen?
So that starts to set us up for this recent study that you did with vaporized THC and limonene. Can you set that up for us a little bit more? What were you guys setting out to do, and what was the basic setup of this study?
Sure. So again, this comes back to largely theoretical work that Dr. Russo had done and others have done, but and written about, and that the industry has latched onto and made claims about. But again, you know, this all started where Ethan called me up and said, "Ryan, you know, I wrote this paper, it was published in the British Journal of Pharmacology, and gosh, I don't even remember how, 2013. It's been 6 years, and no one has done the science to support it or refute it to back it up." And so I said, "That's crazy. Why don't we do it?" Right? And so it set us out on this line of he lays out many specific hypotheses about the entourage effect and about how certain terpenes interact with THC to produce the entourage effect. And he came in as the believer, the one who is, you know, promoting this idea. And I came in at the time of being the scientific skeptic. I was like, there's no way, right? But I like that challenge. I like that interaction. And I think that Ethan and I complemented each other very well in approaching this. And, you know, the advantage of me joining forces with him is that we have a lab set up that we could actually go in and test these things in a very controlled manner. So we felt confident in our approach to it methodologically, and we had the capabilities to do it. So we set about finding funding. We looked a lot of different places. It took us a couple of years to get it going. But like I said, we landed with a grant from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And the idea was to take three different terpenes, limonene, pinene, and myrcene, and to test individual hypothesized effects of how these things would interact with each other. Going into it, based on preclinical data, as well as some clinical studies with humans of limonene, not as part of cannabis, but as an individual entity, that limonene would attenuate the anxiety-inducing effects of THC. And that's based on data from, again, citrus oils being used homeopathically to lift mood, and there's a hospital study that showed it reduced anxiety in a mood disorders wing of a hospital when it was sent out into the air. And it follows the claims of a lot of the cannabis products and marketing. So can limonene reduce the anxiety-inducing effects of THC? Pinene was selected because the hypothesis there is that pinene could reduce the impairment of working memory induced by THC. And myrcene was believed to not attenuate THC, but to exacerbate the sedating effects of THC. And so when you look biochemically at all of the claims about indicas and sativas and things like that, the hypothesis right now in terms of Dr. Russo's beliefs in science and research and in the cannabis industry claims is that myrcene is sedating and will be associated with that couch lock phenomena of like an indica type of cannabis product. So we have three individual terpenes that are available. They're generally recognized as safe, although that doesn't really apply to inhalation. So on the regulatory side, we had hurdles to jump and to clear to get things going. But, you know, we had three very clear, distinct hypotheses that could be tested in a laboratory environment. So we went limonene, pinene, myrcene in order. The limonene study is done and was recently published. The pinene study finished about 2 weeks ago, and we're just getting at analyzing the data. And myrcene study is just getting going. So we're kind of in the middle of all of that at the moment. So I'm happy to talk about the results of the limonene study, and we can talk about generalities for pinene and myrcene, but I have no data to share just yet on that.
Yeah, let's focus on the one that's done with limonene. So I've got it right here. I've looked at it. So the hypothesis is that for escalating doses of THC, you're going to have, especially the higher doses, a side effect of anxiety. So anxiety will be more common at a higher dose of THC. And the hypothesis with respect to limonene is that if you add limonene into the mix at some level, potentially, it will mitigate the anxiety provoking effects of THC. So you should see less anxiety in people who inhale THC plus limonene than you do in people who inhale THC only, or correct, THC with less limonene. So what was the setup of the study? How many people, what type of people, and how did you actually deliver this stuff to them?
Sure. So to kind of go back and talk about our methods. So one of the things that I think is really important that I think we do well is we control dosing. And again, we were very intentional on not just going and getting a high limonene whole plant cannabis product versus a low limonene cannabis product, comparing the two, because again, as we talked before, there could be a multitude of other chemical differences between those two plants that could be driving any difference we see. Mm-hmm.
So you really wanted to isolate THC and limonene only.
We want to be very specific. Does limonene actually do anything to THC? So we purchased synthetic THC. We purchased plant-derived but purified, highly purified limonene. So both were greater than 99% purity. We then modeled a dose delivery method that we validated that if we heated up a THC at a certain temperature in a certain device, we would deliver all of that THC, and the same thing with the limonene. And we made sure that when we heated it at this temperature in this device, we didn't convert these things into something else. So we were very careful to get our dosing methods secure and to work with this. So we opted for inhalation and vaporization in particular. So we know that our doses are being delivered fully and completely, and we're not converting things to other chemical entities through this process. And then we had to figure out, well, what doses do we use? Now, we've done dozens of studies with high THC cannabis here in the lab. We know pretty much how many milligrams of THC it takes to get people pretty high and very high. And so we kind of did that. We picked two doses of THC, 15 milligrams and 30 milligrams, which to the occasional cannabis user will get people moderately high and pretty dang high. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to do that because we weren't sure. We didn't want to sledgehammer everybody and give limonene and conclude that, it doesn't do anything because we completely destroyed them with THC. So we wanted variation in there. You know, can limonene overcome a little bit of anxiety, or can it overcome quite a bit of anxiety based on the dose of THC we're given?
And to help orient people here, so you're going to use 15 or 30 milligrams of THC. Approximately how many milligrams would be in a typical joint that you would buy at a recreational marijuana shop?
So again, you got to do some math there. If you're taking something that's like, say, 20% THC and you buy a pre-rolled joints are usually about a gram. So that whole joint's going to have about 200 milligrams of THC in it. Now, few people will go in and buy a 1 gram pre-rolled joint and smoke the whole thing by themselves.
Or if they do that, they're probably a frequent consumer who has decreased their sensitivity.
Which is not our population. So we want to eliminate high levels of tolerance in this experiment, because people with a high level of tolerance, you can give them a high dose of THC, they tend not to get too anxious. So we recruited people into this study who were healthy adults, had prior experience inhaling cannabis, high THC cannabis, and at least at some point in their past history, had inhaled THC and gotten anxious or paranoid, right? Mm-hmm. So we wanted to maximize the likelihood that we would see this effect so that we could really tell if limonene could reverse it or attenuate it. And so, again, that's just good science, I think. And so we had our target THC doses based on prior studies that we had run. And then we had to figure out what doses of limonene we could use. So I mentioned before, there had been some research on limonene exposure in ambient air, but we couldn't find anything published anywhere in any way, shape, or form of anybody directly inhaling limonene. So we were kind of pushing the envelope there and had to justify ecologically relevant doses of limonene that we believed would be safe to these individuals. We never want to hurt people in our experiments, even though we're talking about inducing a little bit of anxiety. So what we did is we were able to get plant test results from a Canadian cannabis manufacturer. And we looked at tests from 108 samples of flower that spread across, I think, about 20 or 25 different strains or plant genetic types from this company. And we took the median concentration of limonene and the maximum concentration of limonene and said, in a 1 gram pre-roll, how many milligrams of limonene would be in the average and the maximum based on this collection? And it turned out to be the average was 1 milligram of limonene, and the max would have been 5 in a 1 gram pre-roll. So he said, realistically, we know people go buy 1 gram pre-rolls of this stuff, inhale it. So we have direct inhalation safety data from up to 5 milligrams of limonene. So we picked those two doses. So in this experiment, we had people come in initially 9 different times, and they would inhale a placebo or nothing really. We put a little bit of distilled water in the vaporizer, and that's all they would inhale. They would do 1 milligram or 5 milligrams of limonene, 15 milligrams and 30 milligrams of THC, and then the combinations of each dose of limonene and THC together. And so after we did that for, I want to say, about 6 to 8 study participants, we needed to see what was going on. What did our data look like? Were we, did it make sense? Were people safe? Were we doing okay? And then were we seeing any attenuation? And so when we did that, we saw a couple things. One is that limonene by itself was really not changing anything compared to the distilled water on any of our metrics. And we asked people repeatedly throughout the day, how do you feel? Do you feel a drug effect? Do you feel anxious? Do you feel tired? Do you feel sleepy? Do you feel hungry? All of those kinds of things. We have them do cognitive performance tests. We measure their heart rate and their blood pressure, and we collect blood from them. And so throughout these first few people, we saw that limonene wasn't really doing anything. We were successful in inducing some level of anxiety in everybody. And the low dose of limonene was really not changing THC effects at all. And we were seeing a modest effect at the highest dose of limonene. So we asked ourselves, well, that's interesting. We now have safety data at 1 and 5 milligrams to the point where it's really looking inert. We can go back to the FDA and back to the Hopkins Ethics Committee and say, can we go bigger? So we pushed to add a third dose of limonene of 15 milligrams. So we're tripling our highest dose and saying, all right, since we saw a little bit of an attenuation with 5 milligrams, do we get a greater attenuation with 15? And so we did that, and we ran 12 more people in the experiment. And the end result was that the 1 milligram continued to basically do nothing. 5 milligrams was an intermediate kind of qualitative reduction in anxiety and things like that. And 15 milligrams had a robust reduction in anxiety and paranoia compared to THC by itself. So we saw a dose orderly reduction in anxiety and paranoia, the subjective feeling that your heart is racing, so kind of panic or paranoia type cluster of symptoms when we combined the THC with limonene, especially at that higher dose. But it didn't affect any of the other drug effects. And so when we asked people their overall magnitude of drug effect, it was not impacted by limonene at all.
So they didn't say, I feel more high or less high.
Exactly. So when, and that's important, because having the outcomes that limonene changed be very specific to the cluster of subjective feelings that we thought it would, but nothing else, really suggests that limonene isn't somehow interfering with THC absorption. It's not somehow changing the pharmacology. It's not blocking THC's ability to bind to the cannabinoid receptor. It's doing something very unique and very specific to this likelihood of feeling anxious after taking THC.
Did you, were you able to measure blood levels of these things?
So we measured blood levels of both limonene and THC, as well as THC metabolites. And there were no differences in THC levels across all of the dose conditions. Limonene levels in blood were dose orderly, in that 5 milligrams was 5 times higher than 1 milligram, and 15 milligrams was 3 times higher than 5 milligrams. It was beautiful linear kinetics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we feel, you know, after this experiment, pretty good that our methods were sound. And the dose orderliness of the outcomes are pretty set. And so I think this, you know, when I look at the data, I feel pretty good about it.
So a couple questions here. So just to round out on some of the basic results. So just to repeat what you said, the high dose of limonene, so 15 milligrams together with 30, you see people get just as high on 30 milligrams as they did without any limonene, but they have an attenuation in anxiety. And you measured blood levels. They were what you expected. Limonene does not seem to be interfering with the absorption of THC. That fits with the subjective reports you're getting from the patients or from the participants. What about basic physical outcomes? Is their heart racing less? Is their blood pressure different with and without limonene?
So there's no difference in blood pressure, and THC typically doesn't impact blood pressure too much in terms of resting blood pressure. You get orthostatic hypotension at high doses, but we didn't really see that in this case. And anything that we did see was not dependent on limonene at all. Heart rate differences were not observed either. So the cardiovascular effects of THC were static, independent of limonene, which again was interesting because subjectively, the participants felt their heart racing and they were attuned to it more when they had the THC in the absence of limonene than when they got the limonene at that high dose.
They were paranoid about it, you might say.
Yeah. You know, when you think about like a panic type or an anxious, you know, you're attuned to those things. You feel your heart pounding in your chest. But in this case, yes, their heart rate was elevated because that's what THC does. Mm-hmm. But when we added the limonene, people weren't very attuned to it. They weren't focused on it.
So their heart rate was indeed elevated as it was before. They just didn't care so much.
Yeah. And so it was elevated at the same level, no matter the limonene dose. 15 and 30 milligrams of THC reliably and robustly increases heart rate.
Okay. So
cognitive performance stuff didn't really change. And like I said, and it's not just the subjective experience because we asked people about a number of other common THC types of effects. Do you feel hungry? You got the munchies right now. Yes, yes, yes. Levels of arousal. Did you feel sedated? Or none of that changed. It was really, really dialed in on the anxiety stuff. So when we look at this, like I said, I feel pretty good about the effect that we saw. But what's really fascinating to me is, and coming back to our original thing is, but the doses that it took to get there
are not
the doses that we see in flower. Mm-hmm. The ratio of THC to CBD, of THC to limonene, right?
Yeah. In other words, you're saying that you used a 2-to-1 ratio, 30 milligrams THC to 50 milligrams limonene, and you saw this effect, but you're not going to see that level of limonene in flower.
Correct.
So before we get there, I have one more question about the experimental setup here. This is a little bit more specific. So I'll reiterate a couple points and then ask the question. So you've got you've got multiple control conditions. You've got a zero THC control condition together with little or 1 versus 5 milligrams of limonene. You showed that limonene in the absence of THC isn't giving people psychoactive effects. It's not really affecting anything of interest here. So it's not really distinguishable very much from distilled water. So for that control set of conditions, so you've got, you know, nothing and nothing, distilled water basically, and then you've got that with just 1 or 5 milligrams of limonene, but no THC. And could people taste the limonene? Could they smell it at those levels?
So we did everything to maintain the blind in this study. And so one of the things that we do is the vaporizer that we used, the drugs were sealed inside of the vaporizer. They couldn't see it. They couldn't smell it or anything like that. They're not getting the hit smelling either the THC or the limonene when they're using the device. Exhaling from the device, everybody had to exhale through a filter that eliminated any visible vapor as they exhaled. So, you know, going back to our prep for this study, we modeled what it would look like with this stuff. And there's huge differences in visible vapor with THC versus the distilled water versus limonene by itself. And so we had to mask all of that. And so the filter did a really good job of eliminating any visible vapor being exhaled through the filter itself, as well as eliminating the smell. So some people remarked they could get a taste of something, but some people said that there is a taste to THC and to limonene and to, you know, just distilled water.
And was that also true at the highest dose of limonene used, 15 milligrams?
So that wasn't something that we systematically evaluated. This was more people would comment, oh, I taste something. This tastes a little different. But we didn't really get any sense that people, oh my God, this is so citrusy, right? Mm-hmm. So,
and did they know that they were getting limonene potentially?
Yes. So we have to disclose what we're giving to people, but we never disclosed what we were expected to see or what we were particularly tracking in the study.
I see.
So the way the study was described to people was that on a very general basis, there are many constituents of the cannabis plant. We're interested in how they interact with each other. In this experiment, you could be exposed to THC, limonene, or nothing. And the amounts are going to be different across different sessions. You might get something, you might not get any of these things. So it was really, they knew what they could get going into it, but they had no idea how much, there was no communication to them that we were particularly interested in anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And so let's come back to the punchline here. So when you use a 2-to-1 ratio of THC, so 30 milligrams, which is enough to get the occasional user reliably quite high, yeah, and high enough that you will reliably provoke anxiety in many of the cases. When you add 15 milligrams of limonene to the 30 milligram dose of THC, a 2-to-1 THC to limonene ratio, you see the same level of psychoactivity. They still feel just as high as they did. You see the same physical results, heart rate, blood pressure, things like this. You see the same THC-induced effects with respect to cognition and the munchies and things, but you just selectively saw a reduction in this anxiety paranoia side effect.
Yeah, correct. So again, it's specific to this anxiety inducing effect of THC.
So you're confident in that result, but then you mentioned that this is not the same level of limonene, the same ratio that you're going to find in legally purchased whole plant cannabis. So what's your take on whether or not it's plausible that people out in the real world with flower are going to experience
this? So again, any good science experiment generates more questions than it answers, right? And so now we have a path set out for us. You know, I'm not going to go out and say that just because we needed 15 milligrams of limonene to attenuate anxiety in this instance, that high limonene expressing plants can't also do that. Because again, there may be other terpenes that have the same anxiety reducing properties as limonene, you know, linalool in particular, right? It's another essential oil that people use for calming effects outside of cannabis, right?
And in fact, one little factoid I can inject here for people is when you look at, I've studied the chemical composition of commercial cannabis in quite a bit of detail. Limonene and linalool are often correlated. So when one has high levels of one, you often see high levels of the other, which is potentially interesting.
And there may be 3 or 4 or 5 different others that also contribute to this, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but what we can say, and again, coming back to thinking bigger picture, mm-hmm, health, bigger picture, other stuff, right? So as the cannabis industry has evolved with legalization, it's not just flower anymore. And mm-hmm, many cases, manufacturers are pulling all of the constituent pieces of the plant apart through various extraction methods and then reconstituting things in unique and new ways. And so this is one example of how that concept could be applied in that situation. Mm-hmm. So, and it gives us precision on a particular outcome. So what we can say is, you know, if we can replicate this effect, then we can say is inhaled THC, the risk of experiencing anxiety and paranoia can be mitigated by adding high levels of limonene to finished end products. Now, whether that be more plant genetics to further overexpress limonene to where they are now, or it means reconstituting THC and limonene together in a two chemical entity package in some kind of inhaler or some form, something like that, or some other variation. But, you know, this is, I think, important in two ways. It gives us a path for reducing the health burden of people overdosing on THC. It widens the therapeutic window in medicinal applications of THC, I think. And if applied to non-medical use, it might reduce the likelihood that the non-medical consumer experiences this unwanted, undesirable side effect of THC. And again, I think coming back to things, you know, it's going back to THC versus whole plant stuff, the entourage effect, and how is it important? And do we just accept the entourage effect and say, well, because there's an entourage effect, we're happy just to use whole plant cannabis and forget anything that's pure THC? Or do we dial it back and say, all right, let's find out what each of these things do by themselves. Let's find unique combinations and get more precision in our products to direct specific desired endpoints for individuals, both on the therapeutic and non-therapeutic side. Mm-hmm. And can we steer people who are more prone to feeling anxious after using THC towards these kinds of products versus the general whole plant cannabis?
Yeah. If you're a naive consumer without a history of cannabis use, or you're just paranoid about becoming paranoid, you know, you would in theory then recommend them a product with this composition versus that composition.
Exactly. And, so, and it also points, I think, to limonene as being something of interest in the world of anxiety just generally. Mm-hmm. So again, this just adds to a fairly good literature that limonene is anxiolytic. And so a lot of people suffer from anxiety. There's some value in knowing that. And again, it's another path to potentially pursue.
So are you doing basically the exact same experimental setup for pinene and myrcene?
So with the general platform is the same, but there are some unique differences because the hypotheses are different, right? Mm-hmm. And so with pinene, because our hypothesis is, can pinene attenuate impairment of working memory that is induced by THC, you have to get to a high enough dose that actually induces memory impairment.
Mm-hmm. So like that would be a 30 milligram dose, I assume.
Yeah. So we started and tried 15 milligrams didn't significantly impair memory enough and consistently enough across individuals to be useful. So after we ran three people through that and saw no memory impairment, we just scrapped that because it was a lot of extra burden on the participants and cost on us to run those sessions, or really we're getting no benefit. So we're looking at 30 milligram doses of THC and again, three different doses of pinene, half milligram, 5 milligrams, 15 milligrams. We did the same kind of concept there. It's based on the same plant samples from the Canadian producer where we looked at naturally occurring doses. And then we added our triple dose onto the end after we had safety data from a couple people with the lower doses. With myrcene, we'll probably do a lower THC dose because again, we're looking, does myrcene additively or super additively sedate people? So we don't want to start with the sledgehammer dose of THC and then try to sedate them more from mm-hmm. there. we're going to start with a more modest dose of THC in the myrcene study.
I see. That makes sense. So you're doing the pioneer study is sort of it, the study, the experiments are done and you're analyzing the data and then the myrcene's coming next. So it'll take some time before all that data is analyzed and the results are published. Can you give people a sense for in the next, say, 2 or 3 years from your lab and from labs in the same general realm as you, what sorts of things are going to be coming out that we're going to start to get answers to that we don't really have answers to today?
Yeah. So we've got a lot of cool stuff in the pipeline. I think if you look at our published literature, we've done a lot on, well, what's the difference between smoked versus vaporized versus edibles and the same whole plant cannabis with THC, how does THC and CBD interact with each other? Now we're trying to drill down further. So we're going to continue this work with THC and certain terpenes. I mentioned before edible formulations. So Tori's got a study comparing gummies versus brownies versus nano emulsion beverages. We have a study that we're about to wrap up comparing Delta 8 THC to Delta 9 THC through both oral and vaporized routes of administration. We have controlled lab studies with CBG or cannabigerol. We have combinations of THC, CBD, and caffeine. And let's see, we got a driving simulator. So we're taking a lot of the stuff that we've done previously and now pulling it back into the lab and looking at, well, we know what subjectively these things do. We know what these things do on our, you know, little psychology tasks of cognition. But what does it do to simulated driving performance? Because there's a lot of concern with increased and expanding legalization, roadside safety, and how do you detect the impaired driver versus the unimpaired driver? Because biomarkers don't do it. So we need to, we're working with Maryland State Police on training of field sobriety testing. We're working with companies that have developed novel apps that can detect impairment, perhaps in the workplace, perhaps on roadside. How do we triangulate all of that? And then we're still collecting all the biological specimens to see if we can help improve methods of detecting impairment. Mm-hmm. And just understanding, again, what doses lead to impaired driving versus doses that aren't. What kinds of formulations lead to impairment? How long do you have to worry about being impaired after taking a certain dose and a certain route of administration formulation with a certain kind of product? And which ones do you not have to worry about it, right? So, you know, is CBN or CBG or THCV, how similar or different are those from Delta 9 THC? What's the difference between Delta 8 and Delta 9, right? And so all of those things are very important for us to understand from a regulatory and a policy perspective. And so we're trying to, again, continue all of that stuff and understand it. And so that's the focus of our laboratory work right now. Another interesting one coming up, my colleague Austin Zamaripa just got a really good score on a grant. It's not funded yet, but we're hoping it will be. And that'll come back to what we talked about, the role of expectation and expectancy biases and marketing, right? So we're going to be looking at, you know, what's the difference between an indica versus a sativa labeled or branded product. Can people tell the difference? Is one really sedating versus arousing or not? And so if you blind that, do you see differences in pharmacodynamic outcomes?
So given that so many states now have legal adult use cannabis, there's pot shops in a lot of places, people can go out and buy the stuff. The cat's out of the bag to a large extent. These things are manufactured by businesses. There's a lot of marketing and a lot of language that gets used to promote the idea that certain products will have certain specific beneficial effects. You build up people's expectations. Given that reality and given where the science is at today, what advice would you give to consumers, whether they are medically or recreationally oriented, for how they should navigate that product landscape?
So first is do your homework, right? Try to educate yourself and understand that cannabis is not cannabis, that there the nuance that we've talked about today is very important. And understand the differences in THC versus a CBD versus a CBG and CBN and all of the other things. Perhaps the most important thing is the source of the product and what type of regulatory scrutiny it's been under before it gets to the point of sale. And so when I try to think of, you know, if I were to, you know, kind of raise key things on consumer safety, one is the quality control of the product you're getting. And I kind of have tiered levels of confidence in those things. Top tier is pharmaceutical. You know, if you can get pharmaceutical cannabis or cannabinoids, that's by far the best. Then you go state level regulated products. Then under that, it's kind of a mishmash of where am I getting this from? What kind of retailer? And then that becomes really tricky depending on the type of product that you're dealing with. So when you get away from either pharmaceutical or state regulated products, you have retail products that can be purchased from like a national retailer, like Whole Foods or Total Wine or you know, there are big corporations that will carry hemp products. And I tend to trust the large national brands over the thing bought from a gas station that's most likely locally produced under very little scrutiny. In the CBD stores, there are, again, national retail products, and there are the mom and pop type products. And then there are the quote unquote hemp derived psychoactive products that contain Delta 8 THC, Delta 6, Delta 10, THCO, THCP, and all the other letters of the alphabet that come after THC. I have very little consumer confidence in those things. And in all honesty, a lot of those things, while they're novel and new, we have very little, if any, science about what those chemicals do and how safe they are and what any long-term risks are for using something like a THCO acetate. We just don't know. So I think it's buyer beware on the source of product and the type of product that you're buying. And then doing your homework on what's an appropriate dose, what's the best route of administration for you to take to achieve what you're intending to get out of it. So on the therapeutic side, you need to be very mindful of, you know, am I looking to get immediate relief from an acute symptom that is expected to be short lasting? Or am I looking to maintain symptom relief on a chronic, constant, consistent symptom of some health problem that I'm having? Because inhalation versus oral dosing versus topical administration is going to be very different in terms of stability of symptom management. You know, when you inhale the drug, you get the immediate peak effect, and then it goes away really fast, and it goes up again and down. And that's not an ideal time course of drug effect for something that's like a long-term maintenance symptom reduction type approach. You're constantly dosing yourself to maintain symptom maintenance, whereas an oral dosing where you have a longer lasting drug effect is going to be much better. And then, you know, the other side of things is when triangulating and figuring out what type of product and dosing that you end up settling in on is the recognition that on the therapeutic side, oftentimes people can find symptom relief or therapeutic benefit at doses that don't subjectively feel intoxicating or produce any kind of impairment. And many people come into medical cannabis use with a history of using cannabis non-medically and can often revert to, well, when I was in college, I used this much cannabis and it felt really good. Therefore, I should use it the same way to help my chronic pain, anxiety, PTSD, whatever, list any number of things there, right? Not necessarily. And so working with a medical provider who knows medical cannabis and can provide some guidance on product selection, on dosing and things like that is very important, because how you use cannabis therapeutically might be very different from how you use it not medically.
All right. Well, Ryan Vondre, thank you for your time. I'm glad someone is finally doing some of these experiments, and I'm excited to see what you've got coming. So I will stay tuned for those results.
Cool. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.